history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you that have some pretty incredible stories to tell if you take the time to ask them about it and listen a little bit. And that's what we do each week on this program. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And over the years, when we've talked to wounded veterans of World War II, especially those who served in some of those memorable Pacific battles that you've heard so much about, sometimes you hear them say, "Boy, I was so relieved when I got aboard the hospital ship, the USS Solis." But we've never talked to anybody who was part of the crew on that ship, who served on that ship, who worked with wounded soldiers and Marines. And we're going to have that privilege today with 91-year-old Cecil Blackford of Tehachapi, California. But originally from Sioux City, Iowa. What was that like growing up out in Sioux City?
Oh, it was great. In Midwest there, we had winters, we had the summers, four seasons. I enjoyed it. Everything else, going up through school and all that, it was wonderful. Until I ended up joining the war in 1942, and that's when I ended up getting in the service. I was a little older, I'd reached the 18. Because I missed out in the first, second grade. I didn't know what I was going to school for. I wasn't the smartest guy. So after breaking my leg playing football out in the field, and couldn't go to school, so I had to stay home. And when I went back to school, I didn't realize what I'm for, and my grades from F's or D's, and so I jumped up to A's and B's, so I needed a break.
I guess so. Literally a break of your leg. And, you know, one thing you said, some people might be scratching their head. They're saying, "Well, just because he broke his leg, how come he couldn't go to school?" But it probably wasn't easy to get to school.
No, it wasn't. We had about a mile to walk. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I had half crutches. All I know, it did me good by staying home for a while. And so when I did go back to school, I enjoyed it more. It was good, maybe. That's why I had to go into service like in the 11th grade.
Let me ask you about this. Growing up, before World War II, you're 9, 10, 11 years old. You've got these three brothers and a sister, and it's the Great Depression that we've heard so much about, but most of the people listening right now didn't live through the Depression. They have no idea what it was like. What was it like for you and your family?
Well, I'll tell you what. We ate a lot of beans. A lot of rice. Dad was working. He was delivered ice and that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, ice business flipped over because another one moved in that small town. That was it. But what we had, and at that time, you could buy an ice cream cone for a nickel and a dime for a loaf of bread and all that. And because of the Depression, because of that, he had no jobs. So that's why he got on WPA. They only made $52 a month. Mm-hmm. For all that, but we didn't have best clothes. Our clothes was whatever. We had two pair of jeans, overalls, and one was for good, one was for play. Mm-hmm. And you took care of those, really. That's all there was to it. And shoes might have holes in, and, you know, I went through it, but we appreciate it now when we see the prices of everything now. It was rough, but we didn't notice it. We grew up with that idea. We were not a rich family. We had what we had, and we appreciated it. So now we look back, and we think now, what a difference. How can things change? A 5-cent hamburger, now you pay about $4 or $5 for the silly thing, you know.
Different world.
Oh, yes.
Different world. And there was a day where the world changed. You were 17 years old on December 7th, 1941. You remember that day? Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
I was out here working on my bicycle, out in the yard, shining it up, and announced over the radio we had been attacked in Pearl Harbor and everything. That's the first time I heard about it. When that happened, Well, then from there on, everything changed.
How did you see things changing right there where you were? What changed in your town after that?
Well, Bob, my brother, older brother, the draft caught him, so he had to go, but we just took it for granted. And then eventually we moved out of that town, Mobile, into Sioux City, which is 18 miles in. I started growing up, working in school, helping there and making 25 cents an hour sweeping floors and that.
And you mentioned your older brother Bob being drafted into the service, and later your younger brother Walt would get into the Navy as well. But you and your brother Don both decided to join the Navy in 1942?
Well, Don was going to be drafted,
But
I wasn't. But Fane, my buddy, and him and two or three others I knew going in, and I was so tired working, no end to it, doing homework at night, go to school and work. I got disgusted. I told Dad, I said, I think I should go to the Navy. And Dad said, well, son, I'm not the man to stop you if you think so, whatever. And that way I went in with Don and Payne and those others, and from there on, my life changed.
And did you think that you were going to be able to stay with your brother and your buddies throughout your time in the Navy?
I did not give it a thing. My mother, she was only 44. And when I went to service, that was the last time I saw her, because she died in 44. I was overseas at the time, and all of a sudden I get a letter from the gal who I ended up getting married to after I got out. And she says, I'm very sorry to hear about your mother. I wish I could do something about it. I didn't know. She didn't say. And I waited and waited for another mail call. And then they explained to me she had passed away and everything. So, and that was 44. And so then that was the last I seen. And I did hear about that for a month later, because our ship was so busy out there with hauling patients back and forth to different places and everything. And I didn't hear nothing about it until a month later that she was even in the hospital. And I was told that she was asking for Cecil before. Whether she did or not, I do not know.
The last time you saw your mother was
way
when
back
you shipped off overseas.
Well, when I went into the Navy, when I said goodbye.
What do you remember about that goodbye?
That goodbye, I just seen her in the front room, because she wasn't feeling good. She wasn't able to go down to the train or anything. So I said goodbye to her then. You know, so long, see you later.
So they ship you up to Chicago and Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and you're there with your brother and your buddies. Did that make it easier to have those guys around, or was it still tough on you?
Nah, it might have made. We had Christmas at that time together. Don and I would be together for the holiday, and it worked out fine as far as that goes.
You're in the Navy. You're at Great Lakes. You go through boot camp and all that. At what point do you get directed toward being a corpsman? Was that your choice or somebody else's?
That was more or less. When we went through our boot camp and everything, they had the questionnaire came around asking, what is your preference? And they said there was a need of medical men. And it happened to be that my brother read, got the same thing too, and he happened to put in for medical himself.
But so you made the choice. So your brother's continuing in corps school to learn about how to be a medical corpsman in the Navy. And you decided you were ready to go overseas right now. No way.
Oh, yeah. I was ready to go wherever they sent me.
So you volunteered to go overseas.
Well, he said, what'd you do that for? I said, Don, I joined the Navy to see the world, not to see Great Lakes and all that. I was sent to Treasure Island. From Treasure Island, my orders came out, and I'm shipped over aboard the Solis hospital ship, and there I worked in ward for a while. But then I got the opportunity to go to the operating room and work there, and I went up there, and that's where I spent the rest of my time, where sometimes we worked many, many hours straight without, because when we go on the island and pick up these patients, we'd pick them up. Our ship held 600 patients, and when they came aboard, we didn't know where, when we started working on them and everything else, we didn't know when we could quit.
Mm-hmm.
And once we were loaded, we were on our way with a load of patients to be sent to someplace, one of the islands further back. We get rid of them, load up supplies, pull anchor, go back. And we hit many, many, many islands out there. Because we hit the islands of Guam, Saipan, Tinian, Okinawa, Iwo Jima.
Right.
New Guinea, New Zealand, Australia. Our ship was back and forth. We were busy going back and forth all the time.
Right.
When I first got on board, the ship was so loaded, they didn't have a bunk for me. So I had to go down, and they had to be places where the jail, more or less. And so that was my bunk for a while until they got rid of patients for me to be able to get up and get a bunk.
So you spent some nights in jail is what you're telling me.
Yeah, might as well spent a few nights in jail. I had a private room for a while, you know, which I didn't mind a bit.
I'm guessing most people listening have never been on a hospital ship. You mentioned the patient load, you know, 600 patients at a time.
That's right.
It's a pretty big ship.
It is. It's a good size. Iroquois. It was formerly, it was used as a kind of a halfway luxury liner, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to take it back and restore it, rip out this, rip out that, and make it. Because if we had two surgical operating rooms and we had lab and everything, we were equipped to do anything, whatever required of us to do. It worked out fine. Dr. Cole and Dr. Neal was my main doctors I worked under with in the orthopedic department. It was real nice. Wesley Robang, he and I worked together as a team on that third table. We would do other surgicals, but not too many. We kept us with the orthopedic, where we did a lot of the legs and everything, amputating legs and arms and putting casts on.
In thinking about that, I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're in the operating room as they bring in these guys who've been hit by machine gun fire, blown up by mines, by artillery shells, booby traps, all kinds of things that they encountered on those islands. How difficult was that to see these young men in those kind of conditions?
It got, after a while, they were just another number.
Mm.
We had to do what we did, and that's it. I've seen a time where one of them died on our table because operation didn't. He said before he went in there, don't take me in there. I'm going to die, I'll die. And he did. Mm. He died, and that was it. So, I mean, you get used to it. You just don't think when you do it. And hurry up, we got to get through. Quicker we get done, quicker you can get off this table. I mean, that was the doctor's order, so you didn't diddle that around me, you know.
Right.
Be nervous, you just.
Well, I imagine time was pretty crucial because there were a lot of guys waiting for their operation for
right.
What they needed.
Yeah, when they brought him in, a lot of times they have a corridor. If they were due to go into special for treatment or something like that special, it'd be in a corridor, and you didn't quit until that corridor was all cleared out. When the operation was done, cleaned up, you hurried up, cleaned up, and straightened up, picked up the blood and plaster, because you're a lot of orthopedic, clean it up, and then you have another one coming to take its place. You just did it.
What's the longest you think you went without
a
break?
We went 30-some hours one time there without sleep.
More than 30 hours straight of operating in there.
Right through on the table. We were so tired that at that time, I was tired, was through. And I went out and sat on the deck, on the floor, the ground, looking out. And at that time, it seemed like there's two battleships swinging in shells into it. Seemed like it was a Guam. And first thing I passed out. When I woke up, daylight, and I thought, oh, my God, am I going to be in trouble? I thought, left. And I went inside, took a look at the operate in the room, surgical room he's working in, and it was loaded with plaster on the floor, blood. And it's the only thing I can figure out, we must have caught up with a load on at that table, and they must have said, forget it, take off, go to bed, or do something. I don't know. I didn't ask questions because all I know is I was tired. I sat down and I passed out like a light.
Right on the deck of the ship.
Right on the deck of the ship. Yeah. And I thought I had it.
Good thing you guys didn't hit two stormy seas. You know, you might have gone right overboard.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right.
Then he would have had quite a different story to tell. But we haven't heard half of his story yet. Coming up, the things that he saw in the orthopedic operating room aboard the USS Solis and the times that that hospital ship, which was supposed to be immune to enemy attacks, was almost sunk by explosives. You'll find photos and videos featuring Mr. Blackford at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.